Well, hello everyone and good evening. My name is Mervyn King and it's my privilege tonight to be in conversation with Professor Richard Pildes of New York University. Rick is the Sadler Family Professor of Constitutional Law and America's leading scholar on how constitutional issues affect the way our democracy works today. Our conversation tonight is going to be about politics after Brexit and Trump. We're going to have a conversation for about 40 minutes, and then we're going to open it up to you, the audience, to put questions to us, and in particular, I hope, to Professor Pildes. Rick, welcome to LSE.
Thank you very much, Mervyn. It's a great honor to be here with you. First of all, I think of Lord Mervyn King as one of the great public servants of our time, and if more people in government functioned as admirably in their role as Mervyn did in his role, that the amount of alienation and distrust might be somewhat reduced that both of our countries are experiencing. It's also a great honor for me to be at the London School of Economics. I've never spoken here before. I've always thought of LSE as one of the premier institutions in the world for social science work on public policy, so it's a great treat to be here as well. I don't know if it's a great honor to be given the unenviable task by you of explaining to an audience in London and at the LSE the most recent American election and how it happened and what it means, but I'll do my best to try to fill that role.
Thank you. So in the election campaign, Hillary Clinton described at least half of the people who voted for Donald Trump as deplorables. Can you tell us something more objective about, you know, who voted for Donald Trump, what we know about that, and how does this compare with previous presidential elections? Is this a complete one-off, or is it, have there been trends in voting over the years that throw light on this phenomenon?
Okay, so there are a couple of cuts at that question I want to take. One is to disabuse people in the audience of any view they might have that this is a kind of very marginal electoral triumph. We know that, you know, Trump did manage to win the crucial states by relatively small margins. Is this just a fortuity or an accidental kind of development? From that narrow perspective, you might see it that way. But in my view, there's something much larger that has taken place in American politics, not just in this recent election, but over a period of time. And I'll try to explain that in a couple of ways. So one way I like to put this, a particularly provocative way of putting it, is that to understand the most recent election, you need to understand how millions of people who voted for an African-American Democratic candidate twice and a Jewish socialist candidate in the Democratic primary, Bernie Sanders, turned around and voted for Donald Trump in this general election. Because that is the force that turned the election outcome towards Donald Trump. So just to give you some data to back this up, President Obama won something like 709 counties in the United States. We have a little bit more than 3,000 counties. He won 709 counties twice. And of those counties, President Trump won 30% in this election. So 30% of counties that were willing to vote twice for Obama voted for Trump. There were another 209 counties that President Obama won once. Donald Trump won 90% of those counties. If you look at the overall election results, you may know that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by about 3 million votes. But if you look at how well she did in California, just three places, California, Manhattan, where I'm from, and Brooklyn, she won those three areas by about 5 million votes, which means she lost the rest of the country by about 2 million votes outside of California, Manhattan, and Brooklyn. That begins to give you a little bit of a perspective on the geographic distribution of the vote. We focus on the small margins that led Trump to victory in a place like Michigan or Wisconsin, and neglect the fact that a state like Ohio, another one of these Midwest Rust Belt states, as we call them, which has always been right on the margin, Democrat or Republican, over the last many election cycles. Donald Trump won Ohio by 450,000 votes, or 8 points, which is a staggering margin in a state like that. President Obama won the state of Ohio twice. Trump won the state easily. So you look at those patterns, and they begin to be a little bit of a response to the kind of comment that you were referencing from Hillary Clinton during the campaign. Obviously, that comment was a political catastrophe for her. But, you know, as a matter of analysis and going forward in particular, I think it's an extremely destructive way of understanding what this phenomenon is about, what it's an expression of. Again, just some data from exit polls. 78% of people voted for Hillary Clinton if they thought they were better off today than they were 1 year ago economically. Of people who thought they were worse off economically today than 1 year ago, 72% voted for Donald Trump. You have millions of voters who are basically, they were called Reagan Democrats back in the early 1980s, who are essentially working class voters, primarily white, but not only white, because Donald Trump did better with Hispanic voters than Mitt Romney did also, a fact that's underreported. Working class voters who were desperate for change in the aftermath of the large-scale economic and cultural developments of the last 30 years, who were willing to take a chance on an African-American Democrat, who were willing to take a chance on Bernie Sanders in the primaries, and who were willing to take that same kind of chance on Donald Trump in the general election because of their belief that he represented their best shot at the kinds of change that they were seeking. So that's all to say there's something very big that has happened with politics in the United States. This one election is just a sign of something deeper. I don't know if you want me to keep going by showing you this. I put together this slide. You can't see a lot of the data. I don't want to overwhelm you or make you think you need to be able to read this, because the large pattern I'm going to emphasize will be very clear to you at the end. But let me just explain what you're looking at here, because this is a way of trying to understand geographically where support for Democratic Party candidates has traditionally come from in the last 30 years in the United States, and how the Democratic Party coalition has come undone over the last 30 years or so. So the years here at the bottom are election, presidential election years. 1988 starts with Michael Dukakis as the Democratic candidate. 92 and 96 are Clinton's victories. 2000, 2004 are Bush, 2008, 2012 Obama, and then the 2016 election. Okay, that's what the groupings are. Now, those colored bars within the groupings are ways of picking out different geographically sized communities in the United States. I'm tempted, is it inappropriate to get up and go to the screen? So green bars.
This is the LSE.
Yes. After all, I'm an American. I'm, you know, vulgar, and I'll just do things outside the rules. So these green bars represent what are called mega cities, more than 5 million people in the United States. And then you're basically going to be going down by size of the community. So
how many mega cities are there?
There are 9 mega cities in the United States. Okay. The blue bars are the cities of 1 to 5 million. And then we're going down in size. I can give you the figures. Down to the rural areas. Okay. Now, what does this show you over time? In 1988, Democratic Party support is relatively even across the different geographic areas of the United States. Whether you're in rural areas, smaller towns, larger towns, small cities, big cities, mega cities, doesn't vary that much. Okay. When you look what's happening over time, just the very crude pattern, what you see over time is Democratic Party support is going up in the mega cities. And in fact, Hillary Clinton did better than Barack Obama or her husband, Bill Clinton, in the mega cities of the United States. That's where all of these votes came from for Hillary Clinton. She does okay in the 1 to 5 million cities, although somewhat less than her husband did. But as you start going down below those 1 million population cities, the support, this is the 50% line, by the way, Democratic support goes way down. And it's not that this happened in one election. This has been a systematic pattern going back to this as the baseline over the last 30 years of American politics. The Democratic coalition transformed from one with sort of broad geographic appeal in the United States to one whose appeal is primarily in the 9 megacities of the United States and the 1 to 5 million city to a lesser extent.
So what are the characteristics of people who live in the megacities compared with the rural areas that lead this result?
So some of the data, and I'm going to try not to keep overwhelming you with too much data, but it is the London School of Economics, so I don't feel too apologetic with numbers. So some of what we know is the loss, of course, of manufacturing jobs in these areas outside the major cities. It's a staggering figure. One-third of all manufacturing jobs in the United States were lost in one decade, the decade of 2000. I always find that just a staggering figure when I hear that. When you look at these counties in various economic terms or in terms of various kinds of pathologies in the communities, you see the big differences. So for example, Donald Trump did far better than Mitt Romney in counties where the percentage of homes that were underwater, where people couldn't pay their mortgages, you know, as that percentage went up, Trump's relative improvement over the previous Republican nominee, Mitt Romney, went up. If you look at counties where the suicide rate, the drug addiction rate, and the like are higher, again, Trump's support relative to Mitt Romney goes up significantly. So what you're seeing in a lot of these areas, it doesn't explain this pattern fully, but in a lot of these smaller areas, you're seeing the combination of loss of employment and all the, you know, pathologies, cultural pathologies, community pathologies that are associated with that. And I think that voters in this area, these areas, have been experiencing this for a significant period of time because of the manufacturing hit. Then you have the 2008 financial crisis on top of it. And they came to believe at a certain point that the Democratic Party simply did not hear their grievances, did not understand what was happening in these communities, did not represent them. They were, as I say, they were willing to vote for Bernie Sanders, who people forget, but beat Hillary Clinton in many of the areas that Donald Trump beat Hillary Clinton. So Bernie Sanders won the Michigan primary. He won the Minnesota primary, another Rust Belt area. Did very well in this exact same part of the country that Donald Trump did very well in. And so again, of course, there are strands of, you know, very negative forces culturally that are behind the support for Donald Trump in some communities. There's some strands of that. There's no question of that. But to focus on that as the dominant, you know, explanation for what we're experiencing and what you see over these longer periods of time, I think is a serious mistake. And it's certainly a mistake for liberal politics in the United States. It's a mistake for the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party, at some point, no longer seemed to be reflecting the concerns of working class voters in the United States. And one final point I'll make on this, you also will hear people say, well, demography is on the side of the Democrats. You know, the increasing Hispanic population in particular in the United States has been voting predominantly Democratic, so just over time, as more of them become citizens, the Democrats will inevitably become the dominant party. I don't believe demography is political destiny for a minute. I believe that what's going on right now is you're seeing a serious reconfiguration of the political parties in the United States, or at least a play in that direction. And if the Republican Party manages to redefine itself, which I do think Trump is sort of bidding to do, as the party of the working class, once the incendiary rhetoric about immigration, once the barrier or banner, I'm sorry, for that is not carried by a figure like Donald Trump, but by the next Republican in this reconfigured party, if it does redefine itself successfully in this way, I don't see why working class Hispanic voters are not going to vote with other working class voters. As I say, they already voted in higher percentages for Donald Trump than the Hispanics did for Mitt Romney. African Americans are going to remain extremely loyal to the Democratic Party for historical reasons having to do with the Democratic Party being the party that enacted the civil rights laws in the U.S., the Voting Rights Act in the 1960s. But I don't think demography is political destiny. I think people's affiliations are up for grabs.
I'm going to come back to this in a minute, but the way you talk about the loss of manufacturing jobs, the impact of that on many voters in the U.S., it is as if in the last 15 years the U.S. has gone through what we in this country went through in the 1970s and 80s with the erosion of the industrial base. And it may be no accident that the period of the biggest shake-up of British politics was indeed in the 1980s. You know, Margaret Thatcher coming in with her version of Reagan Democrats in Britain, and the potential elimination of the Labour Party as a serious force, which almost happened but didn't quite. But in the US, of course, this loss of manufacturing jobs has coincided with the financial crisis, which sort of doubles up on people's concern. And Angus Deaton and Anne Case have discovered that the really shocking fact that among many working class white people, the life expectancy has been falling.
Yes, which of course has not happened in the United States, certainly in the 20th century.
It's something we associated with Russia, not with the United States.
Yes, and if you look at wages over the last 30 years, there's a lot of talk about wage stagnation, but actually wages have gone up for most groups in the United States with the exception of white working class men whose wages have been stagnant or gone down over that period of time. So now it's also true, you brought up the financial crisis, and I think we've talked about this study before. There's a very good econometric study of financial crises in democracies over 100 years or so of time. And it's a repeated pattern that 8, 9, 10 years after financial crises, since financial crises tend on average to last about that long rather than the shorter time for ordinary economic recessions, that you see a rise of populist forms of politics. It's most often a populism on the right, but there's also a left-wing kind of populism that emerges in some places as well. And so the upswing of populist revolt against the elites, against the system, against the financial elites, the political elites, is entirely predictable in any sort of broad, you know, kind of historical and comparative sense. That tends to be the pattern, on top of the effects of globalization on certain segments of the economy, like the loss of the manufacturing jobs in the United States, which isn't caused just by globalization, it's automation as well, but it's such a striking phenomenon in that one decade. So yes, those are very powerful forces leading to a sense of loss of control of one's future, of one's children's future, and the immigration issue plays into that as well. We can talk about that. But.
So some people have said that Hillary Clinton was a particularly ineffective candidate and that somebody else would have beaten Donald Trump. Now, of course, Hillary Clinton had the problem that in this election, being a consummate insider for 25 years and having lots of experience was rather unusually a handicap rather than an advantage. But is there something deeper here that is a big lesson for the Democratic Party in U.S. politics? What advice would you give them to?
Well, I'm not a political consultant, but but I'll see. I'll do my best. So I think, obviously, there are some particular things with Hillary Clinton that are specific, you know, weaknesses or limitations to her. But I do think that the problems are much deeper, and she, in a way, just exemplifies certain traditions that have developed over longer periods of time in the Democratic Party. Obviously, on the trade issue, you know, Bill Clinton made a decision to move the Democratic Party away from its traditional union-based resistance to free trade, and she was stuck with that position by this point in time. There was simply no way, no matter how much she said, I'm now against the TPP deal, there was no way she could be anything other than a representative of 30 years of Democratic Party policy on that issue, which turned out to be such a powerful issue in this election. But more than that, I think that, you know, she, this is a standard observation that people have made, she represented the way in which the modern Democratic Party in the United States, I think, had moved away from a more class-based New Deal, FDR type of politics, kind of coalitional politics that was economically oriented, much more towards the modern identity-based, focus on fair and equal treatment of various specific groups. And in a very powerful essay in the New York Times by Mark Lilla, that's a controversial essay, in which he's advocating for what he calls a post-identity liberal politics, he had this arresting sentence, if you're going to start doing politics that's organized around various groups you identify with, you better identify with all of them, or the ones you don't will hear that they're excluded and they will not like that. And I think that one of the things that you see in this election is people who believe that their grievances, which are very real and very significant, you know, as I just tried to kind of give a taste of, are simply not being seen, not being heard, not being responded to by the modern Democratic Party. Remember, Bill Clinton was a Southerner. He was kind of, from Hope, Arkansas, from nowhere. He spoke a language that a lot of these people could identify with. They felt connected to him. Barack Obama did a brilliant job of doing the same thing, even as an African-American candidate. He presented himself in very universalistic kinds of terms as an agent of change, and that was not at all the kind of candidacy that the Clinton campaign ran. They ran, by the way, as a technical matter, a very data-based, highly centralized campaign sitting in Brooklyn, in which their campaign manager was convinced that, based on his analysis of the numbers and the data and the like, that they would put together this, it was called the Coalition of the Ascendant. These, you know, the demographic groups, the Hispanics, the African Americans, the young, the liberal intelligentsia, and that would be sufficient for the election. As a result, they did things like not go to the state of Wisconsin once after the Democratic Party convention to campaign. It's unfathomable that a decision like that would be made. That's partly because they're not connected to what's going on out in these places, and they're not understanding the anger, the alienation, the disaffection with the Democratic Party, because, again, it's a highly technocratic, highly centralized, data-based approach to campaigning, which left them out of touch with what was fundamentally going on in major parts of the country, in my view.
I mean, I think that is the one similarity between Brexit and the presidential election. There are big differences. I mean, you were electing a head of government, head of state for the United States, covering all aspects of policy, and Brexit was a referendum on one very specific issue, and people were clearly very involved in that issue. But what I found very striking is that of the 12 nations and regions of the United Kingdom, 9 voted to leave the European Union and only 3 to stay, and those 3 were London and Scotland and Northern Ireland. So every region of England, other than London, voted to leave. And that gap between London and the rest of the country was something that, living outside London, I noticed, but all my friends in London didn't really appreciate. And the number of times I met people, highly professional people outside London, who said, why is it when I go to London and I say I can't decide whether to vote for or against Brexit, I'm told, but if you even contemplate voting for Brexit, you must be either ignorant, uneducated, stupid, racist, and a whole series of adjectives, to which the response was, I'm none of those, and I resent being described in those terms. It was the British equivalent of the deplorables for Hillary Clinton. And I think that reaction against it did play some role. It was a big difference.
London is the megacity.
It's the only megacity we have.
Right. And so in that respect, at least, you know, there is something very similar to the dynamic that's taking place in both of these countries. And, you know, I want to emphasize, because I think people sometimes have the image, it's the big city versus the rural areas. That's much too crude a way of understanding this. It's the megacities against very significantly sized places that are 500,000 to 1 million people in the United States, you know, all the way down to more rural areas. It's the domination culturally, financially, politically, economically of certain cities, you know, whether it's Chicago in Illinois, Atlanta in Georgia, Miami in Florida, New York, obviously in New York, that is being resisted now by people outside those areas who feel that these areas are not responsive to them. This happens, by the way, not just in our national politics, but in our state-based politics. So at the level of individual states, there is tremendous alienation and resistance to the urban capitals from areas outside the urban centers. where, again, if you read the ethnographies of these areas, people are saying they don't understand our issues, they don't see our issues, and you know, how much that's the same phenomenon here, I don't know. Obviously, Brexit is a very distinct set of questions. Trump may be, you know, he's a very flawed vehicle in all sorts of ways for the carrier of these grievances, and but these grievances are real. And eventually there's going to be a revolt if the political process is perceived as not responding. By the way, I think politics is always partly, you know, about material kinds of issues, but also about symbolic, identity, cultural kinds of issues. And I think that a significant part of the dynamic here is people feeling that at least Donald Trump sees them, hears them, recognizes them. Now, whether he can actually do anything for them in terms of material improvement in their conditions, you know, is a very large question, and you know, we will see. But don't underestimate the importance, you know, to people of feeling like at the very least they are seen, they are given a certain dignity in politics by being seen. And for people who feel they've been invisible to the system, you know, the Trump now likes to use the language of the forgotten man and woman, the forgotten person. That's I think, how many of them see themselves.
So these phrases we often associate with so-called populism. But do you think that the rise of these events are simply a response to the financial crisis, to the erosion of manufacturing industry? Or is there some aspect of the way our political process works that has made this rise of populism more likely in the last few years?
Right. So that's, for me, that's a great question, because I study democratic institutional design and the legal framework of politics, and I often think that a lot of our politics is shaped by choices that we don't see anymore. We take for granted that we organize politics in one way versus another, and just think it's natural to have whatever we currently have. So it's true that there has been a rise of populist sentiment, not just in the United States or the UK, throughout Europe, you know, partly in response to all of these changes, cultural, economic, that we've been talking about. But there's also a question of how those forces do or don't get translated into actual democratic politics and elections and systems of government. And we made a very dramatic change in our system in the 1970s that I think makes Donald Trump or Bernie Sanders possible in a way they would not have been possible before this change. And I think most people in the United States are not aware of this, don't think about this, but I think it's actually quite important. So as you all presumably know, because you watch, we now choose our nominees for the presidency. The parties choose their nominees through a series of these primary elections. So it's a process that is completely dominated by the individual voters, the voters of the Republican or Democratic Party who show up in the primaries and vote. And by the way, you don't even have to be a Democrat or a Republican in some states to vote in the primaries. You can be an independent and choose which primary you want to vote in. So this process, which we now, you know, take for granted, only came into being in the 1970s. And for the prior 150 years or so of American history, we had a very different system for how our presidential nominees got chosen. And in particular, you know, in the 20th century, just to focus on that, we had this much more complicated system in which there were a certain number of primary elections, but they were never enough to control who became the nominee of the party. there were also these political party conventions that were staffed by political party members from throughout the United States. And they had to also have enough support for a particular nominee for that person to actually become the standard bearer for the party. So this system, which was called a mixed system, some significant role for the established party figures, some role for voters through the primaries, was a system that had some room for insurgent candidates and outsiders to challenge the established party positions and figures, but they had to do it within a framework in which they also had to stay close enough to the party's, you know, ideology and philosophy to keep on board a significant portion of the party figures from throughout the country. Now, the system was criticized as a back room, smoke-filled, when you could still smoke in a room, corrupt system. But there were many virtues to this system that combined some role for direct voter participation through primaries, some role for people who actually worked with these people, had experience with them, had seen them in office. Once we went to a pure primary-dominated system in the mid-1970s, the role of the party and the party figures was essentially completely eliminated. And there's no mediation now between the voter in the primary and the choice. In many circles, this was celebrated as a great, participatory reform for citizen participation in the democratic process. There's a serious question, I think, in my mind, about whether we are actually, in the United States, better off with a system that has completely eliminated any role for the political parties and has moved to this purely populist system than the system that we had before. There were political scientists in the 1970s when this system was created, when this is really quite a radical change, actually, in the design of democracy in the United States. And when this change was made, there were political scientists who said, this is an extremely dangerous change, it's going to lead, or it makes it more likely we are going to have demagogic candidates who appeal to mass hatreds and populist sensibility, who have no concern for the political party or the party label. It's very significant in this election to remember that Donald Trump was not a Republican, basically, until a few years ago. And, of course, he doesn't subscribe to a lot of traditional political party philosophies and policies of the Republican Party. Bernie Sanders ran as an independent. He has never been a Democrat. He's not a member of the Democratic Party. He doesn't hold his seat as a Democrat. He never did, even during the campaign. So you had two figures who basically were able to take hostage the political party label under this system that we have. You know, both of them are essentially independent, free agent entrepreneurs in politics. Sanders came remarkably close, to being the standard bearer for the Democratic Party, running against the most establishment figure the Democratic Party has. Trump manages to hijack the Republican Party label and successfully, and run as this was something that was simply not possible before the 1970s. Now, what would have happened before the 1970s is, you would have had this populist outrage, you would have had this resentment, you would have had this alienation. It would have found political expression. There would have been candidates who ran to try to tap into that if they were smart enough. But they would have had to do this in a way, in order to get the nomination of one of the parties, that responded to these pressures, but also within a framework that the party figures throughout the country were willing to endorse this person as a appropriate, sound choice to kind of carry these forces forward. It's not at all clear to me that we are better off, in a political system which has out of disdain for the political parties, out of distrust for political party figures, try to kind of eliminate them as any kind of filtering or mediating force in the democratic process in order to give voters direct and immediate control of the process. And let me make one last point about this, which again we probably take for granted and don't really focus on how strange this is. In the Republican primaries, you may remember, there were something like 17 candidates who ran. You had sitting senators who had developed expertise in foreign affairs or national security for many decades. You had governors who had governed over 8 years. Now, how do you sort through this number of candidates? Well, the way it was done is the television networks that were hosting the debates decided that they would use public opinion polls to pick the 10 people who were most popular at that point in time and, you know, put them on the main stage. So you had senators who had been in Congress for 15, 20 years who couldn't even get onto a debate stage, the main stage, because of a system in which the parties, the party figures, the party structure means absolutely nothing. And instead, these public opinion polls, determine who gets to reach the audience that you get to through a public debate. So I think that it's a very interesting question, right, in democratic systems, especially with the greater fragility we now feel in a lot of these systems. How much have these, you know, more, let's say, populist forces always been present latently, but been filtered through various mediating institutional devices that we have now, at least in the United States, mostly eliminated? And so how much more likely have we made it for these kinds of forces to be able to capture control of, you know, American government? And I think somewhat similar things have been happening in the UK, although I'm not as knowledgeable, but I'm curious to hear.
So I think, I mean, there are similarities constrained by one very big difference, which is that we don't have a presidential contest where individuals have to get a nomination and then compete against each other. What we have is a system in which, you know, the parties have a leader, and the question is how that is chosen. And then the party with the biggest number of seats in Parliament, then that leader would become Prime Minister. But the first general election that I really remember was 1964, which pitched Harold Wilson for Labour, very talented, it was sort of the Blair of his age, very talented, technocratically brilliant, against someone who had been a hereditary peer, who resigned his hereditary peerage, and when asked in the election campaign how he thought about economic issues, mumbled that he didn't really know much about economics, but he used matchsticks to do the calculations on the economy, which people loved, really. That probably helped him a lot. But what I remember was that the real bone of contention was how Alec Douglas-Hume was chosen as the leader and the candidate. And the year before, when Harold Macmillan resigned as Prime Minister, the process of choosing the leader was that there was no election. The leader emerged from the leaders of the party, privately, behind closed doors, selecting the person who would lead the party. And Alec Douglas-Hume, completely unexpectedly, was announced on stage by the chairman of the Conservative Party. It was like the Oscar ceremonies, you know, and the winner is Alec Douglas-Hume, to gasps of astonishment from the audience, because they had many other candidates that they thought would be likely to be chosen as leader. And after that election, there was a very famous article by Ian MacLeod in The Spectator saying that if the Conservative Party wanted to be in touch with modern life, it couldn't leave the selection of its leader to the magic circle. And that led the Conservative Party to change its voting system and give the opportunity to elect the leader to the sitting members of Parliament. Now, the trouble with that was that as time went on, we had elections where the number of seats held by the losing party could go down to quite small numbers. So people said, well, this isn't very democratic, is it, when just 150 or 200 people at most can choose the leader of the party and possibly the next prime minister. So then it was thrown to the members of the party in the country. And what you've seen in the last couple of years is that the members of Parliament themselves now recoil from this decision, because on the Labour side, they found themselves with a leader that 90% of the elected members of Parliament in the Labour Party reject as leader, which is a very odd position to find yourself in, though it's not entirely dissimilar to Trump versus Republicans in Congress. And on the Conservative side, where the rule was that the MPs select two people and the top two in their ballot were then given to the party membership in the country to choose between, they went to enormous lengths to make sure there weren't two names that could be given to the party in the country, only one. And so there was no election. And I think this could be a sign for the future that people have become very nervous about the idea that so-called direct democracy may not be the best way of giving the country a choice between both parties and leaders, rather than turn it into a personality contest, but actually to try and give a greater weight to the professional party politicians in helping to choose the leader. There's that similarity, I think, as an issue. But from your observation, do you think that this tendency towards the rise of personalities, and in particular populist personalities, for which television appearances are just vital? You know, as you get very good examples of American politicians with years of experience who simply can't get in front of the American people to make their case as to why they should be president because they can't get enough time on television. And the person who did have the enormous television experience was obviously Donald Trump. And there's, you know, a similar person here. Boris Johnson made his career, became very well known because of television. But do you think that the US is more prone to this swing to personalities and populism than European countries?
In many ways, I think the answer is yes, because you still have, as I understand it, you still have a party structure that is bolstered and buttressed in a variety of ways that we don't have. So, for example, in the United States, campaign finance is basically a matter of every person who's running having to raise money for their own campaigns. You have a system in which you have public financing, right, which is run through the political parties, basically.
Up to a point. We have, you can't buy television advertising. But right. every now and then, right. Politicians get into deep trouble because they have been discovered doing all kinds of unwise things to raise money for the party, which can then be used for poster advertising or paying for advisors or whatever. But the sums of money are a lot smaller.
But our politicians, particularly the members of the U.S. House, are in a far more fragile and vulnerable position than I think politicians in the European democracies. Because keep in mind, members of the United States House have to run every 2 years. And they have a primary election that they often have to deal with. So they may have two elections every 2 years. They don't run as part of a party slate. Mm. And as I say, they have to raise money for themselves in very expensive elections that we have. And so they have a tremendous set of pressures where they're not that protected by a party structure or a system of party-based support and financing. And so I think that creates, you know, an enormous pressure on them to be much more immediately connected. Now, the communications revolution has also accentuated these forces. So it's now the case that if you want to become known politically, you can make a name for yourself completely outside the party hierarchy and the party structure, right? It used to be one of the ways in which individual politicians in the United States were disciplined by the party structure is that they wanted to advance in the party. They wanted to build a name for themselves, get better seats on committees, get chairmanships of committees, maybe position themselves to run for higher office. Now, with social media, you can identify a constituency throughout the country. It doesn't have to be in your district or your state. You can raise money on the internet from this nationwide constituency, and you can completely bypass the formal party hierarchy. And the two best examples of this are two of our most prominent politicians, Senator Ted Cruz from Texas and Senator Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts. So in their first year in the Senate, they were two of the most well-known and two of the most powerful figures in the United States Congress. Why? Because they had figured out a way to make a name for themselves through social media and to raise millions of money from donors throughout the country. And so they didn't need anybody. They had an independent financial and communications kind of base to stand on. Now, if you compare that to the way American politics worked in the past, the most powerful figures in our history, in the Senate, let's say, Lyndon Johnson, who later becomes president, had to work his way up through this. He could never, in his first year in the Senate, have had the kind of power the two of them do. Moreover, it's now the case that people want to run for president as quickly as they can once they raise money and get a name for themselves in the Senate. They don't want to stick around and cast, potentially divisive votes. So President Obama barely passed through the Senate before he ran for a couple of years, and that became the model, and that's what's happening with all of these figures now. And when you think about the way the communications and fundraising revolution works, this goes back to your question about populism and its greater penetration of the American political system today. It's not moderate centrist candidates who are able to make a name for themselves and raise money through the internet from across the country. It's people who can identify themselves as, can stand out in very bold ways. And those tend to be the extreme figures, the more ideologically hard-edged figures that donors want to give their money to from around the country. So if I mention sort of moderate Democratic senators, everybody's worried what's happening to the moderates. We should support the moderates. So one very, reputable one is a woman named Senator Claire McCaskill from Missouri. How many people in the United States have heard of her? How many people, in New York and California are sending her money compared to a Liz Warren, or a Ted Cruz or figures like that? So the communications revolution has enhanced, I think, the forces of populism. And with politicians who are independent entrepreneurs in the United States and very vulnerable in some ways compared to politicians in more proportional representation style systems, I think we may be more permeable to these populist forces. And in addition, this has been implicit of what I've been saying, we have always had the democratic culture whose sensibility about democracy and how to understand democracy has been the most populist and participatory kind of all along. Mm. We have always been, the language of popular sovereignty that you hear a lot in the United States has always had a much deeper penetration into the way our institutions are designed than in the European democracies. We don't have the experience of Germany and Italy and Europe had with the rise of fascist and totalitarian regimes out of democratic regimes, and therefore the greater skepticism or concern, the desire for building in more intermediating kinds of institutions. We have the most participatory, if you will, or most immediate populist kind of structure and institutions of any of the democracies, and we keep moving more in that direction rather than pushing back on that.
So are these forces irreversible, or are there reforms to the way politics is carried out that would maybe help to change some of the less attractive features of these forces?
Obviously there are certain sorts of specific reforms, one can imagine or advocate for or hope for. In terms of some of the larger things we've been talking about, I'm less certain. So the rise of the populist mechanism for choosing our presidential nominees, I think the political culture in the United States would push back very, very hard against any movement back towards a system in which party figures had a more significant role. I view that as probably a very, very difficult situation. I actually thought that if Donald Trump lost the election and lost it badly, that the Republican Party might actually seriously consider some of these reforms so that they weren't so hostage to populist forces hijacking the party label. But obviously that's not going to happen now that he's the leader of the party. I find it hard to imagine that we would move towards a system that re-strengthens our political parties in major ways, which I would tend to favor. I would tend to favor a system of campaign finance reform that if we provide public financing, we provide a lot of that financing through the political parties as opposed to through individual candidates. But again, the reformist energy in the United States is all highly individualistic for the individual citizen. And what people have been proposing and what's been adopted in a few cities is a system of what's called campaign vouchers, where government gives each individual a certain voucher that's worth a certain amount of money you can spend on political contributions. And the idea is that's supposed to equalize, you know, the ability to contribute. But it puts this in the hands of individuals, giving money to individual candidates, weakening any of these intermediary forces that run through the political parties.
Well, I think the time has come for us to find out what views or ideas on reform there are from members of the audience, including those in the upper tier. There are roving microphones. I suggest we take two questions at a time, in order to enable more questions to be put. So it's a question at the back over there, in the middle. And there's one up on the back row on that up there, which would be the second question. So please, sir.
It's Madam. Thank you. Thank you very much for a really fascinating debate, really interesting. I'm particularly interested in your points around how some of the mediating factors that used to function in the US are not there anymore, and the parallel that was drawn was with the UK leadership. I think the other interesting parallel is with the recent UK referenda, and the fact that we have removed ourselves from the representative government route and gone for direct referendum. And the UK has had a number of referendum recently. We had voting reform, we had a Scottish independence referendum, and then latterly the EU referendum. I suppose just your thoughts on how do you do referendum well? What are the conditions for getting good referendum results generally, and how do you how might we do those better in the future?
Right, there's a question there at the back on the upper tier.
Hello, thank you for the lecture. I find it intriguing that the fact that you mentioned the identity-based politics and the fact that politician has to identify themselves with most, if not all, identities out there in order to appeal to the voters. I wonder if people, some would argue that, you know, with globalization and modern lifestyle, these kind of entities like nationalities, race, has been blurred to the extent that identities are not that important when we are talking about politics and elections. I wonder what's your opinion on that. Is that kind of a contradiction of what we've been told in the past few years? Thank you.
Right.
So the referenda example, that's actually a great example. And you know, certainly it is a manifestation of the larger political, cultural changes that we're talking about here, right? The notion that a referendum is what we ought to use as a way for making choice, collective choice, about certain sorts of issues, whether it's, you know, Brexit or other particular kinds of issues. In the United States, by the way, we do not have a national referendum. There has been movements for it. They've not gone very far. But we do have a fairly active process of what's called direct democracy or initiatives in some of our states. They're mostly Western states. And California is one of the most well-known examples of this. There was a book written. California had been very dysfunctional for 25 years or so. It's actually turned the corner and is doing better now. But the major tax revolt in the United States, the first big sign of no more taxes, no more tax increases, took place through a voter initiative in California. And then there were a whole series of initiatives on schools, on prisons, on various issues with profound financial implications for the state. There's a widely held view that the dysfunctionality of California government over the 20 or 30 years that I'm talking about was a direct result of the active use of direct democracy to address all of these policy issues, so that you get conflicting impositions on government. You can't raise taxes, you can't spend more than a certain amount of money, you must do this, you must do that, you must do these other things. Good journalists who studied this process have basically, you know, written books arguing that the California dream kind of died through the direct initiative process. I think the issue is complicated because I think there are certain matters in which it may be justified, may be appropriate, you know, to go to a referendum, a popular vote. So drawing the line on the appropriate use of this device of collective choice versus ways to limit it is tricky. But I just think, as a minimum, your recognition that the rise of the referendum is an option that people think, you know, we ought to do, or is becoming more the appropriate thing to do on certain matters, is a sign of what we've been talking about here. And whether this is a form of, you know, increasing populism or participatory democracy that's a good development or a bad development, I leave to you, I guess, for the moment.
So there's one other point I'd add on that, which is the conventional criticism of a referendum is that this isn't really the right thing to do. We have politicians who represent their constituents, and it's a mistake. People don't really understand all the complexities. But I think that the reason why there is pressure for a referendum often is that the existing party system does not give people a chance to vote on an issue that they really care about. And if there is a big issue where there isn't a natural party division, where the parties represent alternative positions on this, then the demands for a referendum grow and grow. And I think where you've seen that in the UK is exactly on those issues where the parties, in a sense, suppressed debate. And it wasn't an issue that was really a major one at the general election. People couldn't express a view on it. It didn't matter which party you voted for. You basically were going to get the same thing. And I think in the end, on something like the European Union, it may well have been inevitable, either that there was a referendum or that one of the parties would have to represent in a very clear way the position of leaving to give people a chance to vote for it. And in a sense, we saw that in the last general election, where although UKIP only got one elected MP, they had millions of votes. And that they were standing very much on that one issue. And that meant that there was a real need to have this debate, which wasn't actually represented in conventional party politics. But where issues on, for example, major economic policy issues about the austerity versus more expansionary fiscal policies or Thatcher's supply-side reforms in the 80s, where these were highly contentious, but they were represented by the major parties, and people felt they could vote one way or another through the conventional mechanism. And I think it does raise this question of whether the parties we see at present, whether in the US or the UK, actually have lost touch with their, it's not such losing touch with their roots, perhaps, let me put it a different way, the rationale for these parties has changed, and why they were created in the first place no longer seemed relevant. And it's much more difficult now to explain what the parties deep down really stand for. Hence the rise of people who could be in one party or another, but see themselves as the individual who can, you know, save the country.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things about the Trump election success is the disruption that it may bring to the locked up political party configurations that have existed in the United States over the last 30 years. Now, you know, there could be good disruption and bad disruption, and we'll see what it all means. But fundamentally, you know, we have had an extremely polarized political environment. I've called it hyper-polarized parties in the United States over the last 30 years or so, where the two political parties have become much more ideologically homogenous over the last 30 years, and much more sharply differentiated from each other. It's now the case that, you know, the most liberal Republican is far more conservative than the most conservative Democrat. There is almost no representation of the center in the United States Congress, in the formal political parties. And that's a phenomenon that has been taking place and has grown relentlessly every year, every election over the last 30 years. And in our system, with separated powers, it's made the system completely paralyzed. Because if you have one political party controlling, you know, the House or the Senate, and another party controlling the presidency, if we have divided government with parties that are that polarized, that can't find any common ground, then you just can't get legislation through the political process. And what it does is it leads to, you know, much greater use of presidential power, much greater power for the courts. Because Trump obviously does not agree with the Republican Party on certain sorts of issues and is challenging party orthodoxy on certain issues, and because he may gain Democratic support for some of these issues, you know, whether it's on greater fiscal stimulus through infrastructure spending, or in other areas, he doesn't want to, you know, touch entitlements in the United States. The Republican Party does as a way of, you know, dealing with the budget deficits. I don't know where our political party configurations are going at this point. And in some ways, that creates more opening, more opportunity for deals, compromises within the political process than we've had over the last 30 years when we've had these locked in, completely polarized party structures.
Now, two last questions, and then I'm afraid pressure of time is reaching. One here on the extreme right as we look at it, and is there one from the... Yes, over there.
I was going to ask Professor Pildes a question, but I really must take issue with Lord King. As a former Member of Parliament and a former Member of the Scottish Parliament, having fought, I can't remember, 9, 10 elections, I can't remember any of us successfully suppressing an issue. And the fact is that in a general election campaign, and you know, you must know this as well as I do, the top issues that people are most concerned about are the economy,
quick
jobs,
question,
health.
Quick question.
Well, that is it. Well, I'm taking issue with you.
All right.
Because I think the referendum...
You're misled. That's fine. A question from...
Can I just finish the question, okay?
Well, it's not a question.
Well, I'll make a question then. Don't you think...
In 30 seconds,
okay.
We have to finish
I'm taking an issue with it. Don't you think that the referendum should have a threshold? Particularly an important issue like this, which can't be reversed, like a 40% threshold of the total electorate, as we had in the first Scottish referendum.
Question up here.
Yeah, what would the impact of proportional representation be, which was adopted in Germany and France, despite their totalitarian pasts, and could you give a definition of populism?
Rick, take that one.
Well... quick response to the question down here. You know, many countries which use a referendum for certain issues do have a significant threshold of participation that's required before the referendum can be valid. So that's, you know, not an unfamiliar constraint on the referendum process. The question about proportional representation and what was the question? Should the United States adopt proportional representation? Well, it would change everything, for sure. So, you know, part of what... So one of the things I always say to my students is, you know, we take for granted that politics is organized through a two-party system. And there are various sociologists and the like, political theorists who have written about, you know, America is less ideologically fragmented than Europe, and that's why we have two parties. That's nonsense. We have a two-party system because we have first-past-the-post elections from single-member districts, which produce two-party politics for the most part. If we went to proportional representation, there's no question we would have five or six parties. Now, you know, one way I think of the difference between the two systems is in PR systems, you force the compromise and negotiation up to the level of the party leaders. In a system like the one we use and you use, but implicitly a lot of the compromise and negotiation goes on among voters when they're voting and they're choosing who's electable, who's not electable, what trade-offs I'm willing to make. But, you know, a PR is not on the agenda in the United States, and it's partly because... maybe not surprisingly, but the risk aversion in the United States to fundamental institutional change on something like that is very, very deep, in part because of this sense of, you know, we've had the longest continuous constitutional democracy in the world. I said constitutional, so. You know, why risk it? But yes, going to PR would have all sorts of ramifications for the U.S. system. If you want to define populism, there's a good book by, what's his name, Jan Mueller, recently wrote a small book on populism, trying to define it more precisely, and I won't try to repeat his definitions and analysis here. I agree, it's tricky, and you have to be careful about using it too loosely, and I haven't tried to be extremely precise in a definition, but I like the work he's done trying to be more specific about that.
Final comment on referenda. Yes, there are arguments for having thresholds, or indeed even a majority, which you have to have in order for a measure to be passed. We had that in the past, actually, for some of the Welsh and Scottish independence referenda, the earlier ones. But I think the difficulty in the UK is that none of these considerations apply to general elections. So I think since the question of whether an issue is or is not decided in Parliament or in a referendum means you ought to have something that's similar in terms of thresholds or, you know, the majority is required. And we don't have that in Parliament. Now, sadly, the LSE is such a remarkable place that there is another event in the same room on an equally important subject of the future of banking starting in exactly 14 minutes.
Are you on that one too?
No, I'm not. And I fear, therefore, that we shall have to draw this to a close. But let me, on your behalf, thank Professor Pildes for coming all the way from New York.